When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Hello and welcome to Hurt Less, Live More, the show where we explore some pain and anger and all the things that stop us from living a full life because we have so much pain. And I'm JJ, the practical alchemist. With me, as ever, is Dr. Mark Goulston, who is a psychiatrist and coach. And today our guest is a very dear friend of mine, actually, Reg Starkey. And Reg, we're going to go into a little bit about your story, but let me just say that two of the issues maybe that you faced and that you use to dull pain of some kind is gambling addiction and alcoholism. But we want to hear your story. What do you think, Mark?
I'm all ears.
So you're dry now. You don't drink, Reg, and you don't gamble, really. How did you come to that point? And what do you think was it that drove you to use such numbing measures in your life?
My parents had when I was 13. My parents had a pub in Somerset, and this was the year that the late Queen Elizabeth was crowned. So my parents had a pub in Somerset, and they drank and they gambled, and they didn't seem to have a problem with either. But I ended up having a problem with both. And I felt that for most of my life, certainly for the first third of my life, I felt that I didn't fit in. What had happened was that my mother and father, both East Enders, they, as Mark will understand, the East End of London is a sort of sacred place to East Enders. But to the rest of the world, it's an absolute, you know, pit.
And it was at one time. It's coming up in the world.
Okay, it's gone up in the world with Docklands and all the rest of it. But in those days, it was a pit. And my dad worked for a bachelor who was a rich guy who wanted to be a playwright, but decided that he wanted to do something more important with his life and try and improve the quality of life for people in the East End. And he picked me up from the East End of London and dropped me into a private school, which was a very generous and benign thing to do. And he became my benefactor. But practically speaking, it meant that I was made very aware by my peers at school that I wasn't one of them, that I didn't fit in, that I wasn't good enough. And so when I drank and when I gambled, it was to take that pain away. So rather than, as Mark was saying about, you know, a kindly mother and a fun father, it was a society that didn't rate me as anything because of the it was England is a class ridden society.
Yes, it is. And we were talking just before we started recording about how these things can be a substitute for father and mother figures. Yeah, but and you're right. England, well, the whole of the UK in those days was very much class-ridden. It still is to a great extent. And I had a similar experience to you, actually, in that I went to a very posh boarding school when I was 13, which is about the same age, wasn't it? Same age as you? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I went from sort of fairly ordinary household into this very well-to-do boarding school with all the daughters of the great and good, and had to fit in there. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, it's tough.
Could each of you talk a little bit about the pain of not fitting in, you know, and maybe feeling at some level, well, I don't have a right to complain because, look, I'm in this posh school. I've got much more benefits than people from where I grew up from. And, you know, I should be appreciative of it. But boy, it's really painful to be looked down on. And you can get a little paranoid. I wonder what they're thinking about me behind my back. So would either of you be willing to talk about that pain of fear? Judgment, peer rejection?
Go for it.
I'd be very happy to talk about it. It was made very clear to me that I wasn't good enough. I mean, I'll give you two practical examples. One friend, well, someone I thought was a friend at school said to me, I thought you were one of us, but you're of the earth, earthy. And another one said to me, another friend I thought said to me, do you mean your father's not a director of any companies? So those are two practical examples. And we had a school list of where everybody lived. And, you know, most people had quite grand addresses. But my address was the Hatch Inn, Hatch Beecham, which, you know, not nothing wrong with it, but it was an inn. It was a pub. When I was in my French class, I was Monsieur Le Savon. I was Monsieur L'Auberge, and the person next door to me, his father owned a soap factory, so he was Monsieur Le Savon. So everywhere I went, I was made to feel not good enough and different from. And it took me a long, long time to come to terms with being as I am and good enough as I am. And I had a life coach. And I said to him, I don't fit in anywhere. And he said, I want you to rewrite the script. I fit in everywhere. And I've adopted that ever since. So.
Yes. Well, I'm glad. And I didn't really feel the same way, I have to admit, at school. I was saved by the fact that I was actually probably cleverer than most of the girls in my class at school, and most of the kids at school. And so I had that, you know, they kind of weren't able to put me down too much. But I think it was the start of me not really opening up and having my own voice. Mark, we talk a lot about this on the show, about me finding my voice through the years. I think that was the start of me actually repressing my voice because I felt that I had to fit in. And I think probably to a certain extent I did. But it was difficult. And then I would go home and my accent changed. So my accent before I went to this boarding school was a Scottish accent. And then while I was at this boarding school, it became a terribly, terribly posh English accent. And when I went home on my school holidays, my parents were living abroad, my mother would take the mickey out of me for my accent. So you couldn't win, you know, you didn't fit in at school and you didn't fit in at home. And so I started to see myself as an outsider, but I was quite comfortable with being an outsider, but it did have an impact on my life in terms of finding my own voice. Yeah.
Well, can I share something? It's kind of personal because we get into personal stuff here.
Yeah.
So I came from, you know, middle class, not lower class, maybe. And also I lived to support my family and probably spent most of my money supporting my children. They had the brains, but I paid for them to go to Harvard, Yale, and Penn, which are pretty posh schools in America. And what happened is they've developed posh friends and the parents of those posh friends. So to a certain extent, I've often felt less than them. We rarely went on vacations because all my money went to supporting my family. I remember I went to a New Year's party at one of the posh friend's parents. And, and they're all comparing about the trips they went on and their private jets and, you know, these wonderful vacations. And I remember this fellow said to me, he said, "You look kind of low, Mark. What's that about?" I said, "Well, I can't talk about any of those things. We don't go on vacations anywhere. You know, I kind of spend everything on them." And I was really feeling low. And it was really remarkable because this fellow is a little bit on the spectrum, meaning don't expect him to be empathic. And you don't know this about me, Reg, but I've never focused on money. But, you know, I was a suicide prevention specialist for 35 years. None of my patients died by suicide. So I've always focused on helping the world as opposed to making money. And he looked at me and he said, "I can make $10 million in my sleep, but I've never saved a life."
Mm.
And it gets to me now because, when you're surrounded by people that are able to provide for their families and you're not, it's very easy to feel less than. And to this day, I feel I'm glad that my children, I don't think they're snobby. Maybe they are a little bit, but, you know, I'm glad they had that opportunity. They've taken advantage of it. But, you know, all their friends are posh people. And I am probably poorer than any of them by a factor of at least tenfold.
And so, we all seem to have had a little bit of this outsider. Is it a complex? I don't know. But we all felt like outsiders to a certain extent at various points in our lives. How did I get over that? Well, maybe because I kind of had this idea or this knowledge, I suppose, that I was cleverer than a lot of the people that was around me. And so that gave me some self-esteem. And maybe that's what helped me from sliding down into the addiction area of life. I did drink a lot when I was young because I was a journalist and we all drank a lot in those days. Fleet Street and television were very well lubricated. But I could never really call myself an addict other than of tea, I don't think. So what do you think, Reg? Do you think that's what really precipitated you into addiction?
Well, I think that when I drank, I didn't care any longer.
Right.
That was the thing that, you know, a couple of drinks and it would take the edge off things. But I felt like an outsider in my own family, in as much as I was the youngest of four children, and my oldest sister and oldest brother were in fact old enough to be my parents. I don't think they were my parents, but they were old enough to be my parents. They're sort of 18 and 19 years older than me. They were real EastEnders, you know. And then there was a huge gap, and my nearest brother was 6 years older than me. And I was like him in that I was following in his footsteps. He'd been sent off to a private school. He went off at, I don't know, 7 or 8. And that's when I first went off to school, and that's when I first experienced the snobbery. But it got worse when I went to my next school, which was when I was 13. And at that school, when I was 13, the system, we had a fagging, Mark, this will sound very strange to you because of the words as well as everybody else, but we had a fagging system. And being a fag in a British public school was that you were the slave effectively of a prefect. And you had to do things like brush his coat and, make him toast and do all sorts of different things like that. Now, the only way you could get, you did this for 2 years, the first 2 years of your time there. And the only way you could get out of it was either get a school colour or to get to the sixth form. I got to the sixth form. I was a SWAT, my friend Tony Henman, who was the father of our tennis player, Tim Henman, he got a school colour. He was a hero. So even though I was sort of in some ways heroic, I wasn't heroic in the eyes of my peers because they didn't value intelligence. I don't know what it was like at your place, JJ, but it wasn't valued where I was.
Well, it's interesting just listening to you talking. And of course, you know, probably my first experience of this outsider idea was when, as a family, we had moved down from Scotland to London. And for the first, I think, well, I was a baby. So maybe for 6 years, I was brought up in England, in London, North London. And so when we moved back to Scotland, I had a London accent, a North London accent, and was completely seen as an outsider in a Scottish primary school at the age of 7. And so the way I dealt with that was quickly losing my English accent and getting a Scottish one immediately. Now, of course, I'm bilingual and I can do both at the drop of the hat. But in those days, and it was very, very much in those days an issue in Scotland, if you had an English accent, you weren't from round here. Never mind the fact that I was born, you know, a couple of miles up the road. But, you know, speaking like this in those days was a real problem. So, yeah, I mean, I guess throughout my formative years, you should probably say, I had this issue with always being a bit of an outsider. Yeah. And so, and of course, it does feed into, again, Mark, this thing about me finding my own voice, my real voice, because what was I always doing? Finding the voice that would fit in.
You know, we had a guest on the show, Melissa Bernstein from Melissa and Doug, you know, big toy company. And she was very successful, but very depressed. And basically, she was very curious all her life, and she was surrounded by people who were not curious at all. And people look at her like, you know, why do you ask these why questions? And then her salvation was she read Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, and she said, oh, I'm looking for meaning, and none of my friends care about that. And that's been a little bit of my dilemma, is I've been curious all my life, whereas I'm often surrounded by, how are you going to monetize that? Mm. Why are you wasting your time on being curious? What are you going to get from it? And I've just never been able to change that. So Reg, can either of you identify with that?
Well, I would love, before we do identify with that, let's just take a short break right now. We'll be back right after this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, Dr. Mark Goulston, and our very welcome guest today, Reg Starkey. And before the break, we were talking about Viktor Frankl's book and about being curious. Is that something that you resonated with, Reg?
I did. I remember having a debate with someone about religion. This was back in I got back to my village in Somerset, where I sounded like little Lord Fauntleroy because I speak like I speak now. And they spoke like, you know, like Somerset people, you know, local villagers. And we had a debate because he was saying, how can we have in the Anglican church, how can we say, I believe in the Catholic Church when we're Anglicans? And I don't know. It was a bizarre debate about, you know, which is, it's much easier not to be curious. It's much easier just to accept life exactly as it is and carry on and get through the day and have another day tomorrow.
Yeah, I think I know exactly what you're talking about there. And I've probably been curious as well most of my life, which is very handy if you end up being a journalist, because that's kind of one of the prerequisites. You have to be a bit curious about what's going on in the world. But I do see a lot of people just going, you know, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day throughout their life without really being very curious about anything at all. It's not anything that I understand. There is a safety valve in being curious. It doesn't allow you to stagnate and, you know, reaching for the painkillers, whatever those are. What do you think about that, Mark?
I have a book that the three of us could co-author. It's a great title and nobody would buy it. It's called this is a killer title. It's what the world needs, but the world doesn't go after what it needs. It goes after what it's want. And the title is called Lost in Transaction, the death of Curiosity and Wonder.
I think that would sell, except that you'd have to be curious to buy it.
What do you think, Reg? I could do that.
I think it's a brilliant idea, it's a wonderful, the word transaction, you know, to go from curiosity to transaction is a terrifying, you know, change and choice. One of the things that I think about the world today, my world today, is that it's, I have a son who's a journalist and I'm curious. So I look at all sorts of things on Facebook. And when I talk to him, he sort of says, "What's your source?" And I say, "Well, it's just some video I saw on Facebook." And I think it's very difficult to know what information is telling you the truth, or if it's any source is telling you the truth. That's what I find very disturbing. I mean, like today, I've been looking at stuff about what's happening in Maui, and it sounds very sinister, very, very sinister from the Facebook type sources.
So how do you navigate that? It's interesting, isn't it? How we are presented with information and then we have to work out whether we accept it as fact, reject it as not fact, or reject it as just something we don't want to know and get on with our lives. And we're bombarded with this stuff, aren't we, Mark?
Yeah, building on what Red just said, but this, I'm the emo person always in these rooms, is a Lost in Transaction, the death of curiosity, wonder, and empathy. And I think when you look at something that is so horrifying and you don't know how to care deeply, for whatever reason it is, you don't know how to care. Mm-hmm. And I think it can push into one's inadequacy. And rather than admitting one's inadequacy in a deep caring about the horrors that people are living through, it's easy to say, well, there must be a conspiracy. There must be something else going on. And I think it's a way, this is my own theory, of letting people who don't know how to care deeply about anything or anyone, it lets them off the hook if they believe there's a conspiracy.
Well, I totally accept that as a proposition. For me, I mean, I do want to care deeply about things, but I sort of tend to believe in the possibility of everything and anything, and the probability of nothing. So, you know, I think that the COVID-19 pandemic, this information that's coming out now, makes me think that perhaps we were totally misled with the best intentions in the world. I'll grant that, but we were misled. I don't know.
You know, one of the ways I deal with life, and people say that sounds depressing, but it keeps me, gives me an equanimity. I have high hopes of everything and zero expectations that anything will ever work out.
Wonderful.
I'm pretty much there with you on that one. Yeah.
Yeah, because I find that when you have an expectation, you can slide into counting on it too much.
Yeah.
And counting on it singularly and counting on it without a backup plan. And when it doesn't work out, you plummet, but and you feel devastated. But for me, when I have high hopes and it doesn't work out, I'm merely disappointed and I go, ouch, well, that hurt. Time to move on. But it's really served me well to have high hopes and zero expectations.
And I'm just thinking about gambling, Reg. Does that resonate with you in terms of gambling?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the sort of You only need, if you start with £1 and you have 12 consecutive, if you could do it 12 horses that won at even money, but rolling the money on all the time, you know, you make £250,000. Yeah, absolutely. And as you know, I spent years of my life trying to make a fortune. And the psychic change that I went through with, thanks to Malcolm Stern, working with Malcolm Stern, was to switch from, you know, I want to make a fortune to I want to make a living. And all I want to do now is just have enough money to pay my bills and, you know, enjoy the things I enjoy. No longer do I want to make a fortune, but I was doing the opposite of what Mark was saying. I have high expectations, totally unrealistic expectations. I was totally convinced that sooner or later, one of them would come off. But after many years, I decided enough was enough.
It's almost like because you're pushing and because you're constantly focusing on this huge expectation and this deep, deep desire and will, it's almost like it's counterproductive. It won't happen because you're so focused on it happening. It's like you're so intent because the end result is so completely unavailable and unattainable. The disappointment must be huge.
Yeah, it was. And not spiritual, totally transactional, but failed transactions.
Yeah. Do you think that had something to do with your school days?
The expectation at both the private schools that I went to was that we were officer class and we were meant to lead and be the people who, you know, led. And that was it, you know, officer material. My first job in advertising was in an agency where, you know, three people had got together and started an agency and were doing great things and they were making a fortune. And, you know, some people did make fortunes in advertising. And that was my plan, was to make, you know, sell a company for £100 million. Didn't happen, but it sort of nearly happened a couple of times. But yeah, I mean, no, the gambling thing is always, you know, it's the Cohen thing about, you know, looking for the card that is so high and wild, you'll never have to deal another.
It's like finding a four-leaf clover.
Yeah. Are there four-leaf clovers? I mean, do they exist?
I don't know if they do, actually, no. Shamrocks. Have shamrocks got four leaves? But clover doesn't, I don't think, no.
Something I want to run by you, Reg. I've run this by in previous episodes. And it's kind of a theory I have about depression and anxiety. And I think that part of what triggers depression is that people had an expectation that they were counting on too much without a backup plan. And when it doesn't come through, they plummet because of how much they were counting on it. And anxiety, and they go into a depression and a tailspin. And to me, anxiety is you're looking at a future expectation that you think isn't going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, you're going to re-plummet. And you never got over the plummeting from the past that caused you to get depressed. And so what I try to coach people who agree with that is how to take the hit in life, how to take the setback, how to take the failure, how to turn that into ways to become stronger, smarter, develop self-confidence, resilience, self-esteem. And yes, if you win, great. But if you lose, even better, because that's your chance to build those muscles.
Wow. Yeah. That's a very positive approach. I think I'm better at that now because I'm sort of settling for a roof over my head, enough to eat, you know, clothes to keep me warm, you know, interesting things to do, like being on this program. Thank you both for letting me come on, you know, getting involved in UK Health Triangle and the radio station itself. You know, that's all, it's all good enough.
Yeah. And I should just say that you do currently in your the third part of your life, let's just say, you're editing Health Triangle magazine, which is UK Health Radio's magazine. So you do still work. You still keep your hand in. You haven't exactly retired, but now it's not so much reaching for the stars, but just being content with having your feet planted on the earth.
And trying to do a good job at what I do. So I you know, I write a newsletter for a little company, teaching company called China Unbound, which teaches people Mandarin in London. I write notes for Chris Grimes for his podcasts. You know, I do different things that interest me.
So, and you write poetry. You write poetry as well.
And I write poetry, and I might even publish some more, but I don't know. It's even more personal than it was before.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly okay. And I don't know very many poets, actually, who've made a lot of money writing poetry. So you
No. I did a course with Roger McGough, who's probably one of our England's most famous poets.
Yeah.
And he's made a good living, but it's probably from his broadcasting and his thoughts and his books than actually from his poetry.
And he was one of the famously one of the Liverpool poets, and he came up alongside the Beatles and actually was in a pop group with Paul McCartney's brother back in the day, back in the 60s. So, you know, he did a lot of different things. Yeah.
Lily the Pink.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
A one hit song. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think if you're a poet, it helps to die if you want to make some money.
I don't know why I laughed there. That was dreadful. Yeah. I think you're right. I think you're right. Well, listen, we're coming up to another break now. So let's just take that break. And let's, if those of you who are as old as we are, you might remember the song Lily the Pink, and you probably won't be able to get it out of your head now, but see if you can before we come back after these messages from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Hurt Less, Live More with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, Dr. Mark Goulston, and our very special guest today, Reg Starkey, a poet, Reg Starkey. We were reminiscing about poetry just before the break. Mark, I think we'd quite like to explore a little bit more about just going from this frenetic world of having to really make it big to just being happy, earning a living, and just having a quiet life.
Yeah, Reg, if you can weigh in on that, that there's a peacefulness and a calmness if you can transition from if I don't make it big, I'm a failure, to making a living. And being able to, you know, provide for people around you that you feel a responsibility for. But if you're able to address that, Reg, our listeners and both the JJ and I would love to hear from you.
Okay, I'll have a go. I think that for me, it is a question of perception. You know, I was very, very keen to have a beautiful car to drive, to have expensive clothes to wear, even if they were very casual, and to have a lovely house. Those were all symbols of success. And I always said that all I needed was a white wall. At the same time, I was saying to people, all I need is a white walled room. You know, because I write, and all I needed is a white walled room, and I'll be all right. But it wasn't true. But now it is true. Now I do have. It's not a white walled room, but one of the walls is purple, and you know, it's a very, very small space. It's probably the most modest space I've lived in my whole life. But I have, you know, a desk with a window overlooking a garden, and one other nice looking little house and trees, and it's just beautiful. It's all I need. It's all I need. And that's the definition of contentment for me, is having what I need, and you know, having 19 and sixpence out of the 20 shillings in my pound, and having, you know, having that rather than being in debt. I'm not in debt anymore. It's good. It's all good.
I want to share an anecdote with you, Reg, because you might appreciate it, given you're being in your 80s, and I certainly appreciate it. I was a practicing psychotherapist for many years, and one day a very vain elderly woman in her late 80s came in, and she was bemoaning how she would have to get her jewelry, her rings resized because of the swelling in her knuckles. And I tried to be compassionate because, you know, and understanding, you know, you're not judgmental as a therapist, but, you know, I was a little bit challenged looking at her to say, that's what you're worried about. I didn't say that. And then a little bit later, a woman came in who looked like the witch in Snow White, you know, a bent over with a cane, with a big smile, but she had a big smile on her face. And the contrast was stunning. And I said to the second woman, I said, I have to ask you, what's the big smile about? And she said, I was just thinking how great this cane's going to look when I'm in a wheelchair in 5 years.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that is wonderful.
I thought, to me, that is perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. I love that. But there is a piece that comes with not being in the rat race, is basically what we're talking about here. When we decide or realize and go for a change of pace, a change of life, and start living rather than constantly forcing ourselves to achieve things which probably don't even mean that much. I mean, a lot of people do great things in the world, but there is a piece that comes from just taking it a little bit more slowly and doing what is right for us, irrespective of what anybody else may say. So in other words, if we don't feel that just moving away from that need to have the big car and the big house and all the expensive clothes, there is a piece that comes with that.
Well, you know something, JJ, something that you and I have experienced, and Reg doesn't know about this, is I think the commercial world wants to addict people to excitement, because you have to keep feeding the excitement, because the adrenaline crash is more painful than the high from the adrenaline rush, and you have to keep feeding it. But excitement is often at the cost of emotional closeness. And JJ and I would certainly like this show to have a huge audience, you know, attract sponsors and whatnot.
But lately, any sponsors listening, just pay attention to that.
Yeah, please pay attention to your sponsors. And but lately, JJ and I are becoming very close about, you know, things going on in our lives. And we sometimes scatter some of those episodes when we don't have a guest. And at least from my end, JJ, the tender closeness that occurs between us is much longer lasting than let's pursue excitement. Can we get a sponsor? That'd be great. They would love us at UK Health Radio if we got some sponsors for them. But do you follow what I'm saying, JJ?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. In some respects, there wouldn't be that intimacy when you are constantly talking about a sponsor or, you know, trying to bring all that excitement. The two don't go together at all. So I think it's beneficial, and I think it's quite powerful. It is for me anyway, and hopefully for the listeners. I don't know what you think about it, Reg.
Well, I sort of agree with both of you. And I was reminded of a book I read years ago called TV Medium Rare. And one of the things they did, it was about a television station. And one of the things that they did in it was they wrote, you know, have conversations in meetings, and they wrote in what people were saying, but also what they were thinking and what they were trying to achieve, you know, absolutely in parallel. So, and you suddenly realize, and I suddenly realized when I was working for McCann Erickson, you know, I suddenly realized how completely out of depth I was and how inexperienced I was and inadequate to deal with the politics of having an American creative director talking to the creative director of the world. And I'm talking about one little agency in London, which is Harrison McCann, which was their dustbin agency. And, you know, it was a nightmare. And it was, you know, that wonderful world, glitzy world, was also a nightmare. And yeah. I did, you know, I drank too much and I gambled and I was out of control. I was unmanageable, you know, but in some ways I appeared, this is where the perception thing comes back. The perception was I was doing quite well. I was a success, but, you know, as a person, I wasn't a success. I'm more of a success now in my own humble, modest way, doing the things that I like and trying to do them as well as I can.
And do them very well. And I absolutely resonate with what you're saying there, because as you both know, and our listeners might not know, I left television news and current affairs a while back, some years back, and people could not understand why, because surely that was success and surely that was a glamorous world and surely that was the kind of thing that anybody would aspire to do, to be in the television news world and current affairs world, making documentaries. But it was toxic to me. You don't see the other side of it, and you don't see the stress and the pressure. And it wasn't worth it to me in the end. But people still don't get why I walked away from that a couple of decades ago now. Yeah. I'm much happier now. Much happier now doing this, and we don't have a sponsor for this show, and but we do it because we love doing it, and hopefully people love listening to it.
Well, there's value and virtue in goodness for its own sake, and quality and craftsmanship, which is what you both exhibit.
Well, that's very kind of you. Very kind of you, Reg. What do you think, Mark?
I resonate totally with both of you. JJ has another podcast on Alchemy 101, is it?
Yep, that's the one.
And I have another one called My Wake Up Call. And occasionally I'll have a guest on. And recently I interviewed someone who was so professional and seemed to have it all together. And I said to her, I must say that I feel very impressed by you. I feel inadequate next to you. But if my listeners were listening in to you, they couldn't relate to you because you seem to have it all together. Is there anything you could get better at? And she started laughing and she started opening up about all this stuff that goes on in her head that she has no control over, you know, all these things. And she became really human. And I sent her the video. I said, if you're going to excerpt this part. And she works for a company that helps, you know, people, young students with their college essays, she doesn't write it. They don't write it for them, but they help those students really come out and express themselves. And I said, you should take the excerpts where you sound really professional and you send that to the parents. But if you want to connect with those students, you send them all this part where you're talking about how nutty you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Great, great advice. And I think that's a lesson. Again, getting back to what we were talking about right at the beginning of this show, this episode, where we were talking about finding your voice. It's all about authenticity as well, isn't it? It's all about who are you really? And of course, for so much of our lives, some of us are putting on a front, that we're putting on a facade. We're pretending to be somebody that we're really not. But the real connection comes when you're so authentic and you're really speaking from the heart. Don't you think? What do you think, both of you?
Well, I'm going to do I have a pitch to the sponsors. So okay. one of the things that okay. JJ and I said in forming this show, let's have conversations with our guests that are so spontaneous and real that if this happened at a pub, sorry to say that, Reg, but if this happened at a pub, people, if they listened in, they'd say, what we're talking about is much more interesting than what we're talking about. And they'd want to lean in and hear more. So talking to our sponsors, you know, it could be that some of your customers would want to lean in to listen to these conversations because because they are spontaneous. Nothing is scripted. That becomes clearly evident. And you would do well to sponsor us. That's all I had to say, JJ.
Well said. Well said. Hear. I completely agree with you there. And yeah, nothing is scripted. I think that is very obvious. But what do you think, Reg? Do you think that you've become more authentic as you move through life and leave all those other things behind?
Definitely. And one of the things about gambling was I was taught early on, winners if you're used to it, losers if it doesn't matter. Mm. So that was the whole kind of poker face thing that, you know, you shouldn't, you know, be too noisy if when you win, and you shouldn't, you know, show any serious emotion when you lose. And so that is actually total inauthenticity. I think I'm now better than I was in that area, but I'm better off without gambling, that's for sure. And I'm better off without, you know, without drinking. And I completely agree with Mark about the, you know, conversations, because the only time I get fed up with people drinking, I mean, I don't want to stop people going to pubs or wine bars or drinking. It's just that when I'm the only one not drinking and all my friends are drinking a lot, they don't realize how incredibly dreary and repetitive they become.
Oh, yeah.
And it is quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. That's something that, because I haven't drunk alcohol for years either. Not because, well, I didn't have an addiction problem, but I had my body didn't tolerate it anymore problem. So it's been a long time now since I drank alcohol. But when I did, when I stopped, the first thing I noticed was the dreariness of the conversation around me as people got more and more drunk. Yeah. But, you know, I don't want to stop anybody having fun and having a drink.
Mm. I remember when I just recently stopped, I was on a Greek island, the island of Patmos, and we were going through the whole of the 12 steps in a week with an American, really good guy called Hal. And anyway, I was standing out on the balcony looking out across down to the harbour. And I said to my, you know, a genuine friend, I said, God, this is beautiful, but it would be so much more beautiful if we had a drink. And I really believe that. And he said, of course it wouldn't, Reg. It's much better that you're seeing what's really there, you know, that you're seeing reality. You're not taking the edge off everything. But it took me a long time to get rid of that idea that it would, you know, drink would make things a bit better. Because it did, at its best, it did make a few things better. You know, it dealt with my shyness. It helped me overcome shyness. You know, would make me feel capable of dancing, that sort of stuff. But anyway, here I am.
And enjoying life without it.
Enjoying life without it, yeah.
Exactly. Well, look, I think that's a great place to end the show, to be honest. Mark, do you have a last word for anybody here and our listeners?
Well, Reg, here's another soundbite for you. I'm an introvert, and I'm a founding member of the Dread Going But Glad I Went Club, and we could start with that.
That's wonderful. Another book, isn't it? Isn't that another book?
Could be. Who knows?
It could be, yeah. It could be. Well, anyway, thank you so much, Reg, for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And thank you as ever to Mark. And thank you to all of you out there listening to us. We're delighted that you joined us today. Do join us another time for more Hurt Less, Live More here on UK Health Radio. But for now, from all of us, goodbye.